Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week we're digesting what the triumph of Jeremy Corbyn means for the Labour Party. This week saw the dominant triumph of Jeremy Corbyn as he was finally elected leader of the Labour Party. I'm joined by our political editor, George Eaton, and Anoush Kalian, who is deputy web editor, to talk about the first week. George, I'm going to start with you. Let's go right back to the victory speech, the special conference that they had at the QE2 Centre, although the People's QE2 Centre, I saw your gag about that. Was that stage managed well? Because a lot of the criticisms about Corbyn have been that he hasn't managed to present himself in a good way. Was that at least? Was that
well? The speech went down very well in the hall, as you'd expect. A lot of the thousands of, who voted for him were there, but I think he failed to reach out to the country in that speech. It felt very much like a speech he could have given at one of his rallies, and this was his moment in the spotlight. I think even some of his supporters feel that he could have done more to strike a slightly different tone. And then the first few days were, of course, pretty chaotic. He wasn't prepared to handle the media. He pulled out of the Andrew Marr show and then attended a fete in his constituency on mental health instead, which was fine, but no TV crew was informed. So he missed another chance to immediately speak to the country.
I think that's interesting. If you're going to do something in your... And actually, because he went straight from the special conference to the refugees welcome rally again, which is a big statement of what, you know, what he's interested in doing and kind of the people power. But again, you sort of pre-brief the camera crew. And then, I mean, this is my weirdness of this. That's not a kind of weird New Labour, Alistair Campbell, Master of the Dark Arts manipulation thing. That's just a kind of, if you're going to do gestures, like and the whole point of you going as leader of the Labour Party to a gesture is to draw attention to a cause, make sure you draw attention to it. Mm. Anoush, I want to ask you, really, as somebody slightly removed, not probably removed enough for your own taste, but slightly removed from the kind of mad maelstrom of comment about this, do you think it's damaged him permanently?
I think that the way that he looks shambolic is a big problem, because one of the big problems with Ed Miliband's time as Labour leader was not only that the public didn't trust his economic policies, but they didn't think he looked like Prime Minister. And Jeremy Corbyn seems to be doing his damnedest not to look like someone who could be the next Prime Minister. Like you say, from the day that he won, he went straight to the refugee rally. But all we really saw of him was some amateur mobile phone footage of him singing the red flag in a Westminster pub. That's really alienating, because people don't think that's normal, and people don't think that resonates authority.
I think the presentation issue is really interesting, because it's something actually weirdly within the media bubble, I think it's taken less seriously. I think lots of people who work in London in kind of creative professional jobs, actually they might wear like jeans and a shirt to work. You know, there's a whole thing about kind of tech companies specifically have really dressed down. That's actually a symbol of status, is being able to get to work in flip-flops. But for a lot of people, you know, certainly my parents, they would sort of think, well, show a bit of respect, actually. That's kind of how, I think, how a lot of people see the dress side of the presentation.
I totally agree with that. I think it's a real middle-class luxury and indulgence to be so casual and to do things on the hoof like he's been doing, when actually people want to see someone that they trust. And I think lots of people who voted for him were looking for something in him that was new and exciting, but also something that they could believe was actually something that he was taking seriously, a job that he wanted, that he's going to fulfil.
Yeah, I suppose in a way, because he's on a permanent job interview, isn't he? Like he's doing a job interview for Prime Minister. And if you go to a job interview, most people wear a suit. Like, that's not an unexpected thing. But George, it got a bit better on Wednesday, didn't it, with Prime Minister's questions?
It did. Clearly, what Jeremy Corbyn realised in advance was that he wouldn't succeed at PMQs as usual. So rather than trying to play the game, he tried to change it. So he didn't sort of throw punches at David Cameron immediately. He asked questions on behalf of the public. He effectively crowdsourced his first PMQs, had more than 40,000 responses, which some poor researcher, from the sounds of it, no doubt, had to trawl through. And it worked quite well for him. It meant it was quite difficult for David Cameron to attack him. It's a very disarming tactic. If you're asking questions on behalf of the public, you can't simply dismiss them. But it was also fairly easy for him. So he didn't. Corbyn emerged unscathed, but he'd played for a 0-0 draw, essentially. And David Cameron actually is quite good at the Q&A style format, the radio phone-in. It gives him a chance to just repeat his party's messages without coming under any real pressure. And he's just won an election, so we can see that the public clearly have some affection for him. He outpolls his party. If this carries on, and in fairness, the Corbyn team have signalled that this is not going to be how they'll do PMQs every week, then I think David Cameron would be delighted.
I thought it was really interesting to think, and actually I agree with you, it's disarming, because you can't scoff at somebody who is a frontline care worker in the NHS. You just can't show disrespect to them. It would be politically toxic for Cameron. But it did mean that, I think one of the questions actually ended, what would you say to Nicole? And the trouble was, it turned out what David Cameron would say to Nicole was, stronger economy, fair for all, you know, we've invested money in the NHS because we've made the tough savings. And you got those lines. It was actually as well, not in PMQ's terms, not that rowdy. I thought there was a difficult moment early on where one of the Tory backbenchers said something about, you know, would David Cameron join with me in paying tribute to the heroes of the Battle of Britain? And David Cameron very much lowballed that. He didn't turn that into a political... There was some slightly waspish phrase about, you know, I obviously have huge respect for the veterans. But I think he probably realised that that would be, you know, if you're seen to politicise that, it's fine for the papers to do that. But if you as the leader of the Tory party and the Prime Minister do that, then you have just turned people's sacrifice and death into a kind of cheap PMQs jibe. George, from inside the Corbyn camp, first of all, how much has he managed to build the sort of lower ranks of the ministerial positions and his own team now?
So obviously he has a shadow cabinet in place, and the reshuffle was fairly chaotic. He is, I'm told, as we record, set to announce his shadow ministerial team, the full team, his own team. He's fortunate in that he has Simon Fletcher, who is his chief of staff now, who worked as his campaign director and was previously chief of staff to Ken Livingstone during his time as mayor of London. He's well respected across the party by all wings. They see him as a serious professional. And he's also brought in Neil Coleman, who worked with Fletcher at City Hall, both under Ken Livingstone and under Boris Johnson. He's going to be his director of policy. What he's lacking at the moment, everyone said there's a clear need for, is a spin doctor, is a director of communications. Carmel Nolan, who was the press spokeswoman for the Stop the War Coalition, fulfilled that role during his campaign. And sources tell me that she's in talks about possibly making the transition to his office. Because I think one of the things that the election showed is that all of the so-called little things that people on the left might sometimes dismiss as unimportant, Ed Miliband, the bacon sandwich, and
The Ed Stone,
and the negativity around him beating his brother and so on. Actually, this does all matter, and I think the election showed that, because the one thing all the post-election studies show is that Labour's leader was a problem for them. And I think all of those negative impressions, all of those negative images of Ed Miliband created cumulatively a disastrous image for him. And if it was a challenge with Ed Miliband, someone who had been in the cabinet, someone who could put on a suit and by the end actually look quite smart and telegenic, it's going to be an immense challenge with Jeremy Corbyn. And so Ed Miliband's pollster, James Morris, wrote recently for the Staggers that leaders of the opposition have about 17 days to really define themselves. That's between their sort of victory speech and then their party conference speech. Mm-hmm. And your Jeremy Corbyn doesn't have any time to waste on that front.
That's very true. And Anoush, I think, you know, the criticism of the media coverage will be no one cares about this stuff. You know, it's all sort of bubble, you know, it's day to day, it's just kind of tiny micro froth. Is there anything that's happened this week that you think that will, I was going to say, we'll be sitting here in a podcast in 5 years' time still talking about
it? Yeah, it was a really bad look for Jeremy Corbyn, who went to a Battle of Britain commemoration ceremony thing, and he didn't sing the national anthem, whereas everyone who was standing with him did, including Michael Fallon. And that looked really bad, and people will say, oh, this is, you know, the right-wing media picking holes in Jeremy Corbyn's principles and trying to embarrass him. But actually, if an ordinary person sees that clip on 6 o'clock news, that's off-putting for them. Most of the country like the monarchy, they like the Queen. I think it's 68%, they polled the public last week, 68% of people think the monarchy is a good thing for Britain, and they're not going to vote for someone to be their prime minister who refuses to sing the national anthem.
For me, it's about you know, there's that kind of great idea of, you know, concede and move on about policy things that you do. But I feel the same thing kind of applies almost to principles, which is that does it mean that much to you to make a stand on this kind of thing that you will risk, you know, people who are suffering under the benefit cap not getting a government that reduces the benefit gap? But then I know this is going to be wildly unpopular, because, you know, I think you have to have priorities. You cannot be, actually, this is something that no one wants to say in politics, you cannot be intensely principled about every single thing, because you have to work within a system that is kind of corrupt and broken and always, you know, tuned. And you're but one person working in that system. You have to decide what really matters. You know, if you can only get one thing done or a couple of things done, what do you want them to be?
Well, no, exactly. You can't realise your principles, however strongly you hold them, if you don't get into power, which I think is something that Jeremy Corbyn and all of the people who voted for him have sort of slightly forgotten. I mean, on that same day that he was caught up in this national anthem row, when it would have just been much easier for him to have sung it, you know, the Tories won this vote on cutting tax credits, which is a huge problem for lots of ordinary families in this country. And it seemed like the debate was in the Labour Party was just in completely the wrong place because of their leader's, like, first blunder in the first 2 days.
I also think there's a way out of that, which is to say, it's not the system I would have chosen, but it's the system that we've got, and I will work within it, but I will work to change that system. Mm. I mean, that's always been the problem with particularly, you know, people who want things to change on the left. When you're arguing against a change to the status quo, which already, you know, advantages your enemies, there was a whole discussion when Barack Obama was first elected about whether or not they would take campaign financing. And you can say, well, I would take a very principled opposition to it, and no, we won't have big donors, and then we won't get any power and we won't do it. And, you know, we won't be able to change any number of other things. You have to decide what things are the things that you absolutely won't budge on, I think. Mm-hmm. Well, that's our first of probably many of such podcasts. I have to tell you, George, I'm so relieved that the Labour leadership election is over. It felt like it was going on for years and years. And at least there is now a leader. There will be policies. There will be a conference speech. You know, we'll have substantive kind of things to talk about. But for now, thank you, George, and thank you, Anoush. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.